there's a part of socialization where you start to be treated like you deserve better and you suddenly want better. You can start to envision better. What does better look like?
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome to At Home on Air. I'm Susie Stadler, the Executive Director of At Home with Growing Older and the producer of this podcast. At Home on Air is a forum to explore the work it takes to be at home with growing older, but also the delight which can come from doing this important work. These explorations are made possible through the insights of inspiring guests from the arts, architecture, construction, medicine, social services and beyond, and through comments and questions from you, our listeners. So thank you, everybody, for being here. This season of At Home on Air, we are inviting community builders and placemakers to discuss their vital role in keeping us healthy and connected, and examine how activism and advocacy are sparking new models of community through affordable housing projects, grassroots organizing, and more. So I am really privileged to welcome Lydia Branstein, the executive director of the Gubbio Project, a San Francisco-based nonprofit which offers a daytime shelter to unhoused adults at St. John's in San Francisco's Mission District. Welcome, Lydia, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I'm so excited to have this conversation.
We named this episode together, Creating an Urban Sanctuary for Safety and Health. And urban sanctuary sounds very different from daytime shelter. Lydia, what makes the Gubbio Project, what makes this space a sanctuary versus a daytime shelter?
Thank you very much for that question. Also the opportunity to sort of talk a little bit about the model of care that we engage in at Gubbio. Gubbio was originally started by the amazing Father Louis Vitali, a Franciscan friar, who was inspired by the story of St. Francis and the wolf. And that's how we got our name, Gubbio. And for those of you who don't know that story, the basics of the story is that when St. Francis came across the town of Gubbio in Italy, there was a wolf that was menacing the town and scaring the children and eating their chickens. So they were gathering together the townspeople to go out and to kill the wolf. And St. Francis asked them to stop. And he said, let me see what I can do. And he went down and he had a conversation with the wolf. And the wolf was saying it was old and it was unable to hunt with the pack anymore. And the only food that it could get was, you know, these caged chickens. It was alone. And so St. Francis brokered a peace between the wolf and the townspeople, saying that if the wolf was to sort of watch out for the chickens in the pen, that if the townspeople fed them, that would be an agreement that they could both live with. And there is still a statue in the town of Gubbio of the wolf. What's behind the meaning of this story is kind of the heart of our project, which is that when we come together as a community and see each other for our vulnerabilities and our ways that we can assist each other, and since seeing each other is in conflict all the time, that we find a safer, kinder way to sort of move forward. And so that's the basics, sort of the ethos of how we think about our project, that we are an organization that sits within a community with lots of different kinds of people with different needs. And how do we both fit into the community while being service to people who are in crisis and in need in a community of people who are housed and businesses and all the other things that come with being in a city? And one of the things that was really special about this project when Louis started it was he said he was working at St. Boniface in the Tenderloin. And it was this big, beautiful church that was empty most of the day And he would walk outside and people would be sleeping on the street. And so the Gubbio project was opening the doors of the church and allowing people to come and sleep inside the church during the day. And that's how we started, right? So, how are we a sanctuary instead of a daytime shelter? Is that we see ourselves as a place that is open and is welcoming, and that people don't need to come here because they're making an appointment or they're trying to get something. This is a place where they can rest and they can be at peace and they can be welcomed. And we have other services that they can engage in, but it's not the primary source of the work that we do, which is just to allow people to be in a sacred space, a church, where they can feel safe, where we can do some healing for some folks who have felt like they have been pushed out of a religious community, to be able to welcome all people in. So there's spiritual healing, there's rest, and there's services attached to everything that we do.
Yeah, Lydia, this is just such a unique offering, and in a way, very simple to take a church in its original function as a sanctuary and open during the day and make it available for people who need this sanctuary in a city. I'm curious, can you tell us a little bit about what other services you sort of have linked to this vision?
So part of what happened was during the pandemic, shelters like ours were all closed because there was no congregate space. People couldn't stay in a congregate space. And there was this idea that everyone who was unhoused was put up in a hotel. But that really wasn't the case. It was a very small group of people who were in a certain age range or had a certain medical health issue that were housed in hotels. Everyone else was sort of left to the street. There were no congregate meals at the time. There was no places for shelter. There were very few places that people could go in to use bathrooms. There were no showers. I mean, it was a really, really rough time for people. And the city, allowed tents to be put up because there was zero shelter for these folks at the time. And so coming out of the pandemic, one of the things that we started to see as we reopened up is just how much neglect people who have been living in tents on the street had experienced. At the same time that COVID was happening, we were also having a huge overdose crisis. 2021, 836 people died of overdoses in San Francisco, and I think it was 134 died of COVID. Many of the people who lived in these encampments would talk about the only time that they really saw government was the coroner coming to pick up a body of one of their friends. And in this kind of an atmosphere, the drug use just escalated a lot. And at the same time, we have new drugs coming on the market. Heroin really kind of dried up after the war, and fentanyl is much cheaper to produce, it's much easier to transport, and it's much more potent. And so this was a new drug that was just killing people at a rate that's just really alarming, When we reopened, these are the people we're seeing. There was a big push to take away all the tents, to clean up the streets and all of these things as we all came out of our homes. And while that was something that needed to be done, the groundwork before it hadn't been done. There weren't enough spaces. There's still not enough spaces in congregate shelters. So it was just this big sort of convergence of like people are coming out of their homes. They're seeing people in crisis and desperate states. They're kind of horrified by it, feeling like you're watching someone suffering over time with no ability to fix it, causes people to move from sadness to anger. We've become a city that's become less tolerant of people who are experiencing poverty and addiction and mental health issues. Those are the people we're serving. So it seemed unethical and not sufficient to merely open the church to bring people in to sleep when people are coming in such desperate conditions. They needed health care. They needed harm reduction care, connection to treatment. Treatment spaces were still not completely open. It was one person to a room instead of four in many of the buildings. So, very limited amount of treatment available. And they needed access to overdose response supplies like naloxone and Narcan and breathing masks. So, here we were, a very small community I had been working at St. Anthony's and I left St. Anthony's to kind of take a little bit of a break. And when this opportunity opened up post-pandemic, I was on the board of Gubbio. We had no executive director, we had no staff, we had a little bit of money in the bank. St. Boniface aligned more with St. Anthony's at that time. You know, they too are a church that requires someone with a little bit of a deeper pocket than we had. And so I came to St. John's to kind of scope it out, and I saw this beautiful garden, this gorgeous, beautiful garden, and this church that doesn't have pews. So it's a big, beautiful, empty space and a community of people who wanted to welcome the community back in. They're like, when are you coming back? You know, I said to the three other board members that we had at the time, I was like, well, give me a year. Let's see what we could do. And so I kind of pulled some people who I'd worked with for many years together, and we started what we call partnering with a purpose. One of the things that COVID did do for the city was it really created a connection to lots of city departments. As the manager of the dining room at St. Anthony's, for example, I had to work with city departments to provide food to SROs. People weren't able to come in to get their food. We changed the entire function of the dining room. We were able to leverage that engagement that we had during COVID to say, hey, you've got street medicine that's out looking for people on the sidewalk, but we've got people here where they can actually get care with some privacy. So street medicine came twice a week. UCSF started coming. We had foot care that came. We built a harm reduction program. We just started growing and growing, and all with kind of bartering. You know, we've got the space, we've got the people, you have the skill, come and do it. And over time, we've gone from being a program that was open 5 days a week from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. to now we're 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Monday through Friday. We have lots of different partnerships. We got a contract with the Department of Public Health because we were able to prove our theory that if you provide people with a safe place to be and opportunities to make healthier choices, that they will make healthier choices, that people believe that people who are living on the street who are experiencing addiction or mental health issues also don't care about their health. And that is something that is just not true. We had a guy who came in and he had a wound on the back of his head. It looked like someone had poured hot oil on it. He was missing skin and he didn't want to go to the doctor. He was like, no, I'm not going back to the hospital. I don't do well at the hospital. They're not nice. Da, 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 da. And I said, well, you don't have to go to the hospital, but what if we were to get you to like the clinic, you know, Martina X? And he was like, no, I can't. Ambulances. I said, well, what if I drive you? And he was like, well, and so I said, can I take a picture of the back of your head? And I took a picture and I showed it to him. And he goes, oh, that is bad. And I'm like, it's bad. So here's this guy who's wearing clothes that are very soiled. He's got a huge wound on the back of his head. He's very infected. He's nodding out from having used fentanyl. He gets in my car, and what's the first thing he does? He puts on his seatbelt. We all have this instinct to take care of ourselves, you know? It just becomes overwhelmed sometimes by need and suffering and being in a system that you're trapped in. So I always like to think of that story when people say, oh, these people don't care about themselves and they're just this, that, and the other. And I'm like, no, they're just in full survival mode right now. And we got to ease them out of it. That was long-winded. I'm not sure if I answered the question.
Well, you answered a couple of other questions on the way. Something which you touched on, and maybe you can say a little more, is that, you know, there is so much suffering on the street that empathy has sort of transitioned to anger among people who live in San Francisco. And one of the things you have been working on is to try to create community and understanding between unhoused and housed neighbors through various outreach, building this empathy back. Can you talk a little bit about how you're going about this?
Yeah, sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't. That's just the reality. I think that otherwise, really good people who are decent human beings when it comes to the topic of people who use drugs or people who have mental health issues on the street say things that are monstrous. I have a neighbor who came up behind us when we were doing an overdose reversal, and he said, "I hope you run out of Narcan and he dies." I just spoke to him at a different time, and I said, "My heart hurts for you that you feel this level of anger." You know what I mean? I was like, "It's more painful for you clearly than it is for me." Like, that was a very painful thing to say. I think the thing that's really important is kind of reminding people on both sides of the boundaries of our expectations. You know, on the one hand, we have our unhoused community who doesn't have a place to be. It's cold at this time of year, wants to put up a tent, you know, has things that they want to take out. And COVID kind of removed a lot of people's sort of like social intelligence around where and how to be. Open air drug use pre-COVID was not great, but it wasn't what it is now, because for 2+ years, people were just left alone to their own devices. And so you have to kind of re-establish some of those boundaries. And the same thing with people who are housed. For a couple of years, there was no one on the streets. And they wake up one morning and the neighborhood is busy again, and you're on 16th and Mission, and you expect it to be Noe Valley. And I'm like, you're on 16th and Mission, and this isn't a gated community. And while we're not going to have people set up tents and pull out all their stuff on the street, our unhoused neighbors do actually get to walk down the street. They get to live in your community. They get to sit on a park bench. You know, they are a member of our community. So there's boundaries on both sides, a give and a take. It's like, if someone parks out in front of your house and takes out all their stuff and uses drugs, you know, yes, you have the right to come out and say, this is not acceptable for my space. That's okay, you know? But at the same time, walking down the street, yelling at people, calling them names, telling them they're a waste of time or space or energy is not helpful. It's not kind. And ultimately, I think it wears down the individual who's harboring that kind of hate and anxiety. The people who are on the streets, it's so hard already to metabolize that there's a future for you that is better. If you're constantly being told that you're just a waste, that takes a toll on people.
Yes. I'm wondering, in your immediate neighborhood, have you been able to forge alliances with businesses there or do some training?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do de-escalation training with some of the local restaurants and or coffee shops like Manny's. I went and did de-escalation training with their staff. And I think that people are just genuinely, again, sometimes confused about their ability of like, hey, what's my boundary? Are the bathrooms open for folks or are they not open for folks? And it's okay to say our bathrooms are for customers, knowing that if you're in a highly impacted neighborhood for people who are experiencing homelessness who may want to use your bathroom, that that involves a certain kind of training as well. That what you don't want is you don't want someone going into the bathroom using fentanyl, for example, and overdosing and no one being able to respond to that. So there's responsibility on both ends. But I think what's really important when we have these conversations is like, what are you able to do? What are you not able to do? And like everyone understanding what the boundaries are. I went and saw this wonderful shaman, and he had this thing where he was like, boundaries are when I can love you and me at the same time. And I love that definition of them, because so often you feel like you have to give something up in order to feel like you're being welcoming or whatever. I think that it's really important that people really understand like, hey, here's the rules, here's the boundaries. And there are going to be times when you push against them, like our guests who have mental health issues. And we're going to have a conversation about that. But if this is going to be a community, it's a two-way street. It's not a one-way street. And that's the difference between our program and some other programs, is that we see ourselves as a community. And so this community comes with responsibility, meaning that there's things that we don't do in this space.
Lydia, what you just said, boundaries to love you and me at the same time. The base of this is what you previously mentioned, this respect and kindness. This is really the core.
Yeah. Well, something I learned as someone who has not been rooted in Christian faith, something I learned at St. Anthony's from Barry Stanger, who was the executive director there for many years. He was a former Franciscan friar. What he said about dignity, he hates when people say, I'm giving you dignity. He was like, dignity cannot be given. Dignity is inherent. Whatever my beliefs are, that resonated with me in a very, very deep way, that every human being is a dignified being, and that respect is honoring that dignity. A lot of times we say, oh, we give people dignity and respect. And I'm like, I just like to pull that apart a little bit because it's like we don't show dignity and respect to people. People have dignity, whether they are on the street, experience the worst day of their life, or they're in a very grand palace. The dignity doesn't shift. The question is how we respond to that person. I've often said if someone was lying on the ground, in Laurel Village and Pacific Heights, and they were wearing a nice outfit and some heels, everybody would stop and help pick that person up. But when we see someone who's disheveled and is clearly experiencing homelessness and is maybe on drugs, that's a different level of experience. That's something we want to avoid.
Thank you for saying this so clearly. That's something really to take away and into the world.
When I was working in the Tenderloin, I was part of a group called Safer Inside that was trying to open supervised consumption sites, which is a very controversial topic. And it's a red herring that we could go down the rabbit hole. It's not going to happen now. But people would talk about the toxic experience of children having to see people who are on the street using drugs or sick. And, my daughter, who is now 17, I was pregnant at St. Anthony's, and she was in and out of that job all the time, came there after school, all this kind of stuff. Never felt traumatized by seeing folks experiencing homelessness and trauma on the streets. She was not traumatized by it. And her father is someone who also experienced homelessness and addiction and died during COVID, but she did not experience it as a trauma. She experienced it as a part of a broken system. Like she saw the people as part of a system that wasn't working, not as like this person is a bad person. And I remember that one of her friend's moms, they were walking down the street and the mom said, "Watch out, here comes a tomato." And that was the code word for someone who was homeless or someone who had mental health issues. Cecile came home and told me that story. And she was like, it's so wrong to refer to someone as a vegetable. The person was just walking down the street. There's a part of this which is a learned behavior, and I always say it's like when we talk about taking care of people who are at their hardest moment in life and they're living it out on the street, and you're saying to a kid, get away from that person, get away from this person, that the child in their brain understands. Because if you ask a kid, like, what's going on with that person who's lying on the street, they will likely say they're sick, they're not well, they're lying down on the street, there's something wrong. When we as parents shun that person, the message that we're giving to our children is that some people get taken care of and some people don't. And inevitably, you're going to ask, which list am I going into? Am I going to be the person who's going to be taken care of? Or if I fall down, if I have issues, if something happens to me, do I become one of the people that's not worthy? And so this comes back to that idea of dignity, that when we see everybody, and that's not to say that people aren't challenging. I often get asked, like, where is God in your work? Because I've worked in institutions that are in churches. And I always say, like, God shows up in my work on the day when I'm dealing with someone who is cussing me out, giving me a really hard time, having the terrible day, and I want to throttle them because I'm just like, I'm really trying to like help you out here, but you're not able to receive it right now. And that's a very frustrating place to be. And that's where that spirit will show up to be like, this isn't about me. This isn't about my feelings. We have to have some distance from that. It's hard work. It's very rewarding.
Yeah, we hear it all in how you speak, Lydia. It is very hard, but also very rewarding. One question I have is, since we are an organization which is supporting older adults to live better in their home and in the world, how many of your clients are older adults, and has this changed over the years?
I mean, I will say that the overdose crisis has really hit an elder population of people who use drugs for years and were able to maintain it. And then with this new batch of drugs that are out that are so potent, it's taken out a lot of our elders. There are more people who are living on the street now as elders than I think ever before. We've got a gentleman right now who has dementia, is non-compliant, had a spot in an SRO that he's been in for 6 years. He got written up last year because he hoards and he doesn't clean, and his room is unsanitary, and they had to go in and clean it. So that was a warning, and it re-amassed. And so he was just recently evicted. He's incontinent. He is unsteady on his feet. He has chronic high blood pressure, and he is incoherent a lot of times. And so this gentleman has just now been put out on the street. And this is the story of many people where he's right in between that age. He's 59. He is moving into his elder years. But he's not in that pool of numbers, that 65 and above, where he can get a different kind of housing. And I don't know that he'll make it on the street. I have another woman who has an apartment, years and years of abuse, and she's a tough, tough old bird, excuse the phrase, but I love it. She's a tough one, but she has some cognitive mental health issues. She believes that there is a giant anaconda living in her apartment, and she sleeps in the alley behind the church almost every night, even in the rain. And I'm like, you need to go inside. You need to go to your apartment. There's a snake in there. These are the parts with our elders who do not have a generation of family that's lifting them up, who are isolated, who really can fall through the cracks. And it's really unfortunate. The other side is the volunteer program, both here and formerly at St. Anthony's, has been such a blessing for an elder community where my mother-in-law, who came in to start volunteer when she was 83, she was like, I've made new friends. I have been losing friends for years. All of her friends come from different walks of life. But they all had that volunteer experience in common. And even though she's in her mid-90s now and she's not able to volunteer anymore, that group still meets monthly. Again, this is the idea of community, that community diversity is age and race and gender and spirit and sexual orientation and religion, all of those things. Creating a diverse community can be challenging, but it's also so rich when it works well.
And it takes time.
You are listening to At Home on Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
So Rachel said, I would like to know what I would see if I walked in the middle of the day. What does it look like? How many staff are there? And are people sleeping? So it's very quiet. What is the scene? Are children allowed?
While we do have some people who will bring their children in, we will immediately redirect them because we have a harm reduction program here, and the vast majority of the people who come in have a lot of issues. It's not an appropriate place for a child. The second you start bringing children's services into an adult space, the rules change dramatically. And there are very few spaces in San Francisco for people to be who are adults. There are very few spaces. So I'm very protective of this not becoming a family service. It's an adult service. There are lots and lots of wonderful family services out there. When you walk in, St. John's is almost built like an old-time castle. There are walls all around. It's about a quarter of a block that's completely sealed with the church at the far end and a beautiful courtyard in the middle with redwoods and a big, beautiful tree that's in the middle of the yard. Right now, it's bright red. So, if you were to walk in through the garden, what you would see is a courtyard filled with chairs and a coffee station. And people are sitting in the chairs, having coffee, having conversation, people going through their bags. You know, like I mentioned before, going through your bags and sorting through your stuff is something that is very disorienting on the street for folks. But here they can do that. You can take everything out. You can put it all back in. You could do it all again, you know. And then when it gets to a point where it's taking up eight chairs, I'll be like, and let's pull it back in. In the back where we used to have a parking lot, we now have a shelter for an RV. So it looks sort of like a barn. And back there, we do all of our wellness services. So we have harm reduction set up there where people can come in. They can speak to our substance use disorder specialists who provide them with safer use supplies, Narcan, and every person that comes in goes through an orientation to let them know all the services that we have. And then the linkages to care that are available. So we start really slowly by saying, hey, you know, if you're interested in any form of treatment, here's what is available for you. We move about 38 people a month, which is a very high number for an organization like ours, into some form of treatment, whether it's methadone, Suboxone, or an in-house treatment facility. We also have the only Spanish language contingency management program here, which is a program for people who are using stimulants to be able to sort of work down their stimulants. They get paid when they have a clean test. And then they also have therapy and all kinds of stuff. And that's been one of the most successful programs for stimulants, which don't have medication that you can support with. Then, if you were to go inside the church, we have cots laid out. We have 60 cots, and most of the cots are full. And those cots are filled with people, dogs. We have a few cats. People can come in with their pets. Some people push the beds together if they're a couple so that they can be close to each other. It's quiet, it's respectful. We have staff at the front of the church who have a big charging station so that people can charge their phones while they're sleeping. Anyone who's doing any kind of social service now understands that phones are vital for getting placement anywhere because no one meets in person anymore. And then we also have a phone booth that people can use to call for a doctor's appointment. We have direct service where if someone comes in and says they want to come off of fentanyl, for example, we get a doctor's prescription for them that day for Suboxone, which is a medically assisted treatment for fentanyl use, and we can get them that prescription that day. We'll take them to the pharmacy, pick it up, and then we'll get them into either a restore program where they can stay for up to 6 weeks while they're looking to further their treatment, or into SOMARISE where they can stay overnight and then go to treatment in the morning. The thing that's so vital about getting that medication that day is someone's willpower is about half an inch thick because fentanyl is an incredibly powerful drug that is incredibly difficult to come off of. It makes you feel like you're going to die. Every liquid you have in your body is going to come out of every orifice within 8 hours of not using. So imagine being on the street without medication, cold turkey is literally very painful and torturous and very difficult. And what fixes it? Is a quick hit of fentanyl and it all goes away. So that's what people are dealing with, right? Getting that medication in them that day before they're able to take that next hit will stop that from happening. They don't get high, but they don't get in pain either. And then it's really about therapy. It's about therapy and like finding what those wounds are and healing them. We have two bathrooms. That's the other thing we're challenged with. We have two bathrooms for about 150 people. My office is in between the two bathrooms, I'm delighted to say. Does that give you an idea of what it looks like?
That's really helpful. Thank you. I also just looked at the picture on your website, which really helped put it into context and was very heartwarming to see how awesomely beautiful the space is.
We have arts programs here too. The beauty of the space is central to this program because, again, I feel like it's honoring the dignity of the human beings. We put up these tents in a parking lot, and then we put up some metal chairs and a plastic table and, coffee with a stir stick. And it's like, and we're going to heal you now. Well, I'm sorry, but honestly, it's one step off the curb, and there's a part of socialization where you start to be treated like you deserve better and you suddenly want better. You can start to envision better. What does better look like? And then it's the idea that people really want a quick fix, no pun intended. Our society wants us to like resolve an issue that was decades in the making with an individual, decades, sometimes their whole life. I have a gentleman who was in congestive heart failure and really wasn't doing well and wouldn't go see the doctor. And he was like, I was born on the street, I'm going to die on the street. And he's in his mid-30s, and he's smart and funny and wild. And I was like, well, what do you mean when you say you lived on the street, you're going to die on the street? And he was like, when he was four, his mother died. He was given to his grandmother. When he was seven, his grandfather died. And the grandmother didn't want to raise a boy. That's what she told him. I can't raise a boy. And so she crossed state lines to drop him off with CPS in California from Oregon. And he was in the system ever since. He went straight into juvenile. He acted out. Imagine being told that your family doesn't want you because you're a boy. It's impacted his whole life. He's been incarcerated since he was a child, in and out. So when I tell him he's going to be in the hospital for 6 weeks, I was like, you're going to need antibiotics, you're going to need these things. But if you do this and we follow up with the healthcare and stuff, we can get you housing. He's like, I don't even know what that's like.
Yeah, a mountain unimaginable to overcome.
Yeah. And so it's like, this is not someone who's service resistant. This is a person who has been institutionalized in a way that was traumatic and sees institutions as an enemy, not as a healer. And so each person requires a different level of healing. We finally got him to a place where he was willing to go to the hospital. But it took us a minute and it took us a lot of kind of like, I want you to meet this doctor and I want you to meet this person. They're going to take care of you here, there, and the other way. He's like, my thing is just like, if I die, I die. I was like, well, true enough. Once you've died, the tears are for the people left behind. But what happens if you have a stroke and then you don't have choices? Choices are made for you. We want you to be healthy so that you can still make choices for yourself. Getting people to sort of think in a frame of mind of both their own autonomy, but also like, how do you move someone towards health when they've not seen it?
You are a sanctuary for people who have had a lifelong trauma, which is pretty amazing. Pat, you said you were a fan of the Guvio Project. Can you share why you are a fan and how you came across the Guvio Project?
I'm sure it was a couple of years before COVID. I think I saw an article in the San Francisco Chronicle. And I read it and I thought, what an amazing idea. So I wanted to do something. I asked my family at Christmas, instead of giving money to me, give some money to Gubbio. Then when COVID happened, things were not good. And then when COVID stopped, it seemed like there was a whole big adjustment, which Lydia just alluded to and described. So it was just like, this is something we need. Working in San Francisco, seeing how unhoused people are treated is just awful. And I understand the discomfort. I understand when somebody runs up to me like they're a hungry dog and asks me, could I go to the drugstore and buy them some stuff because I don't like being dirty. But just to have that personal contact, if you can have the humanity to say hi and smile at somebody, it just seems like Gubbio is treating somebody as if they really are a human being, not some wild animal that we have to avoid. I went down when they had an open house. I met people there and I saw the space in person. It's one thing to see it on the site. You get off at the BART station and you walk up with people spread out over the sidewalks. Every inch of the sidewalk is its own little store, right? You're stepping over people who are selling a box of Tide. Even getting there was interesting. And then talking to the volunteers who work there, the people who bring the hot coffee. Do you serve food? I know that you have hot coffee for people, but I don't actually know if you have food for them.
We do now, and we do get visitors, but honestly, not a lot. And also, people tend to not see what's inside here, which is a benefit for us because we're kind of walled in. People will come in and be like, I had no idea this was here. We remodeled the kitchen. We got some money to do some work in the church. And so we now do three good nutritional, we call them snacks because we don't have a meals program. I think today it was chicken legs and gravy and rice and then oatmeal in the morning. And most of it is by donation, but we do now have a kitchen where we can cook and we have a kitchen manager. People really love the food. They really do. And it's so important. Again, if someone is rested and fed and they've got time, the likelihood that they're going to spend the time talking to the nurse goes up.
I'm filled with this conversation and so many thoughts about how to really build community amongst people who are in the street amongst us. And I just wanted to really thank you, Lydia, for the work you do. And I also want to take this opportunity to thank everybody here, because I know that everybody here does wonderful work to make this a better world. One last thing is the beauty of the space. I'm so glad you mentioned this because everybody deserves beauty. And part of us building community is beauty.
Susie, I just wanted to sort of end with an idea, and we talked about this earlier, but we never kind of connected it. I was asked, like, how do you do this work? And I go back to the idea of the Tibetan mandalas and how the monks will spend hours and hours building these beautiful, colorful mandalas. And at the end, when it's fully complete, you just sweep it away. The ability to do this kind of work and to remain kind is not to be attached to other people's outcomes, but rather just to be present with them in the moment and, you know, accept them for who they are at that time. And so I'm very grateful to be able to do this work. I've met so many amazing human beings that are so resilient and fabulous. And I thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to talk about our community. And come on
Yes,
down.
we will.
Thank you.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.